Yes, and welcome to Animal Voices. John Robbins, author of The Food Revolution, said that the meat-eating Prius driver has a bigger carbon footprint than the vegan Hummer driver. So we see from that that livestock production is indeed a massive contributor to global warming. About 1 billion people alive today do not have enough to eat. A third of the children in the developing world don't have enough to eat. Everyone needs to eat. And it is not efficient to cycle grain through animals. The production of 1 pound of feedlot beef requires 16 pounds of grain. 16 pounds of grain makes a large quantity of bread. Some 90% of the corn grown in North America is fed to animals, mostly chickens. So, to get more information about this, go to earthsave.ca. Something wonderful you can do for yourself and all life on Earth is to eat a diet of organic, unprocessed food that is free from animal products. You're listening to Animal Voices, coming to you on CFRO Radio 102.7 FM in Vancouver, also known as Co-op Radio, your commercial-free, community-based, and community-sponsored radio station. Alan Jensen is in the control room. My name is Carl Loskin. And in the studio today, we have Marge Adams. And what will you be doing today, Marge?
I have a wonderful story about a courageous gorilla and her heroic efforts to save a little boy. I'm looking forward to reading that. And then I have an item from the Vancouver Sun regarding pet drugs and the prices that we have to pay for them.
Thank you, Marge. And within a half a minute or so, we'll be speaking with Deborah Talbot, who is the Executive Director of the Australian Koala Bear Foundation. At the half-hour mark, Bob Timmons from the Animal Rights Collective, ARK, Animal Rights Collective, collective spelled with a K, based in Toronto, will inform us about shark fin products that are currently on sale at stores such as Shoppers Drug Mart, Costco, and many health food outlets. Well, we're very privileged to have with us today Deborah Talbot. She's the Executive Director of the Australian Koala Foundation. The koala bears are the real Australian living legends. Welcome to Animal Voices, Deborah Talbot.
Thank you very much, Carl.
Yes, and so, well, we always say koala bears, but that's not really correct, is it?
No, they're actually a marsupial, but while I'm here in North America, it's amazing, even I start calling them bears, so, they aren't related to any bear, but they certainly do look like one, that's for sure.
Now, they are only in a certain area of Australia.
So yes, they're on the east coast of Australia, which is where, I mean, although Australia is as big as the United States, most of the fertile land in our country is really just like the strip of the California coast. So the koala habitat in Australia is about like New York to Miami. So that's why the pressure for urban development and farms and all sorts of things has affected the koala so much over our short history.
So they're quite endangered, are they?
Yes, I believe that there's probably less than 100,000 koalas left in Australia, and the only figure you can compare that to was approximately 10 million being killed for fur back in the 1920s. So there's been a marked reduction in numbers. And we estimate approximately 80% of their habitat's been destroyed in that time as well.
Now, they're marsupials, so maybe there was an evolutionary process that what made these animals, develop pouches over millions of years?
I think when we were talking the other day, I told you that in the 1800s, when the British biologists actually came to Australia, they were quite disinterested in the animals of Australia because they regarded them as submammalian. You know, they really thought that mammals were more important. And I think that really, in a way, our country is such a primitive country, it's like time stood still a bit. And so this was part of evolution. And I suppose over time the koalas might have ended up mammals, but Probably because the habitats are so harsh that it was much better to put your baby in a pouch and look after it that way than to sort of end up being a mammal and then having a small little animal to carry around with you. So, yes, most Australian animals are very unique this way. Platypus, wombats, and of course our really weird-looking platypus who's... in fact, the British biologist in the 1800s thought someone had played a joke on somebody, that sort of sticking animals together. So we have quite a weird array of animals, and of course the koala is the most beautiful of them all.
So I love it how you say that time stood still. Mm-hmm. And but of course here we always think, well, you know, there's the comforting idea of mother and child. Mm-hmm. And of course we always think here that we need to be protected from the cold, but that's not quite so in Australia and on the East Coast.
It's very hot. And in fact, the koalas at the moment, we've had so little rain, even though I heard yesterday that where I live we had 10 inches of rain in one day. But for the last 10 years or so, Australia has been suffering from a shocking drought, and koala numbers have plummeted, we think, because of that. And of course, bushfires have been increasing, and in some parts of Australia it can get to 40 degrees Celsius. So yeah, the koalas have to really, they've got quite a harsh landscape.
So now their diet is quite singular, and it's, one would think the eucalyptus is a somewhat, unusual diet.
Mm-hmm. Well, if you and I ate eucalyptus leaves, we'd get very sick, and what the koala has done is adapted to this leaf very, very well. And they're really the only animal in Australia that eats that, and so they live happily up in the trees. But they do actually have to have quite a variety of eucalyptus. There's actually nearly 800 species of eucalyptus in Australia, and the koala in different parts of the country eat different eucalyptus. So the way I like to describe it, it's a bit like having a steak and vegetables and ice cream and peaches. You know, they actually have a little bit of this, a little bit of that, and they blend it together. And it actually keeps them extremely healthy. So what I have seen in recent times, because we've been destroying the environment so much, that the koalas have actually been, just eating one species of eucalypt, and then you just suddenly see them losing weight and then getting sick and dying through disease. So it's just like us humans. We need a well-balanced diet to have a long and healthy life.
That's right. Now, in spite of their diet, they're not all that active, and they're nocturnal. I was really surprised.
Yes, well, they actually sleep 20 hours of the day. And given that I'm jet-lagged at the moment, I wish it was me. But they are active around about dawn and dusk, so they're not really technically nocturnal, but you do tend to see them more movement at night time. And indeed, that's why a lot of them get killed on the roads, because they sort of start moving just as dusk is coming, and that's when people are driving home from work. And so I think some of your listeners might be shocked to know that in the last 10 years, just where I live, 25,000 koalas have died from dogs and dog attacks and cars. So, you know, a modern world is a very harsh place for koalas.
So they come down from the trees, and they sometimes eat some of the soils, and of course it's in farmland, and there's pesticides there. It doesn't...
The role of pesticides has not really played a huge part in my life. I mean, we're so caught up with destruction of habitat that I think that's the real issue. But certainly on the west of the Dividing Range, which is a bit like your Rocky Mountains, there is no question that koalas suffer a different fate. But on the east coast of Australia, where we're just, really turning into California in a way, it's just big highways, lots of new houses, and the koalas just get moved on.
Now, the mating habits, it's a patriarchal society, is it?
Yes and no. I think when we radio tracked 15 animals for over a 3-year period, it was really interesting to sort of see social behaviour in koalas. And in fact, I carry a picture of one of those koalas in my diary, a dear old boy, which had a radio frequency of 501. So he's my man, 501. But it's clear that he passed on his habitat to his son, and we called him Arnie Schwarzenegger because he was such a big animal. But what we also saw was that the females were very selective about who they bred with, and one female called Marie had a baby to this Arnie Schwarzenegger one year, and the following year didn't have a baby, just sort of stayed in her territory. And then the following year she bred with Arnie, and on the way home had a little affair with a man called Dennis. So what we learned from that is that she had two children of two different animals, and it meant that genetically the population's much stronger. So I often joke with our male scientists that men always want to see, you know, men as being top dogs. But I think that the females in koala society are making quite serious decisions about who their babies are going to be.
Right. Arno makes a good match there. But now they only have one young every 2 years. And, of course, as you said, there's only 100,000 of them left. I mean, that's really catastrophic.
It is. And this is the thing about the environment. Because I've been working in this job now for 20 years, and I've seen so much destruction, and I, you know, people talk about tipping points, about how bad things can get or how good things can get. I'm really genuinely concerned, and one of the reasons I'm in the United States is that, you know, I really think Australia needs a wake-up call about how precious these animals are, how important they are to not just Australia but to the world. And I'd love people to visit our website, SaveTheKoala.com, and just have a look at the maps. You know, it actually shows how much habitat has gone, and I think that speaks for itself. And I am very concerned about the future of the koala, and I don't think that we're talking extinction tomorrow morning, but I do think that you have to have strong genetic material, and once you start getting down to 10 or 15 or 20,000 animals, then I think you really have a long road to recovery. And I think you knew that I've just been up in Churchill looking at the polar bears, and there's only 23,000 polar bears left in the world. And we saw about 40 of them, and one mother took these two little cubs out onto the ice, and it almost made me want to cry because you realise you're talking about potentially the last of a species. So I think all of us who love animals really need to write to our politicians and say, hey, we expect you to take care of them as well as us, you know? And I sometimes think the animal world does get forgotten.
It does. And we also see a difference between, so glad you went up to Churchill and saw the bears there.
Yes.
But also a big difference between Canada and Australia is that most of the large tracts of the land is public land, it's crown land. And but in Australia, it's mostly private land, and that, of course, presents another kind of problem, doesn't it?
It does. Encouraging private landholders to actually protect biodiversity. So you imagine if you're a farmer and you want to grow your crop, and you've got these trees there that are needed for koalas. Traditionally, you used to just knock them down. And so certainly some of the things that I focus on now in my work is to try and work out how can we encourage those landholders to protect that biodiversity. And I think that over the coming years, when we have carbon trading and trees of the planet will become sort of in a monetary value, I hate to say it, but I think that sometimes none of us really appreciate a tree for its beauty alone. But once there is a carbon market, I think it's going to be easier to encourage farmers to keep some of that biodiversity. So in some respects, I think there's a bright future coming, but there's still a lot of discussion and vision that needs to be put into those plans for the future. And on my trips to the United States, they're the sorts of things that I think about and try and learn so that I can take all that back to my country.
Well, we're talking with Deborah Talbot. She's the Executive Director of the Australian Koala Foundation. The webpage is SaveTheKoala.com. And such a privilege to have her here and tell her she's been to Canada, she's seen how the different countries manage their wildlife. And we want to try and help that the koala bear, which is truly the icon of Australia. It's everybody thinks it's a wonderful, cuddly little animal, but that may not be so.
Yes, well, it's interesting because sometimes when we're out in the bush and our researchers are radio tracking animals, I can tell you when you capture one of those animals, They don't look like the ones on my website, which are, you know, sort of animals that have been brought up in a zoo and are almost like domestic cats, really, because they're quite sweet. But, yes, koalas can be quite aggressive, and if you try and take them out of their territory, I can assure you those big, long, sharp claws can do a lot of damage.
Well, and also they must have teeth to munch away at those eucalyptus leaves there.
Yes, well, I've been bitten a few times, I must confess. You know, I have my photo taken a lot, and sometimes they'll sort of turn around, and I remember once, they're like little rabbit teeth at the front, and they sort of nipped one of my eyebrows, and I can tell you, it hurt like heck.
Well, if they only knew that how much you cared for them, they wouldn't do that, would they?
Well, it's so funny. I was, in fact, next week I'm going to Cornell University to give a talk, and when Cornell was in Australia about a year ago, they were recording the voices of koalas, you know, the grunting, and you can actually hear that on our website too. There's a grunt when they sound like a pig grunting, actually. But anyway, there was this dear old koala called Velvet. No, a Scarlet. Scarlet.
Okay.
And the females often don't talk, but as every time I walk past her, she sort of makes this sound at me, and the keepers say that she's talking to me, so perhaps she does know how much I love them.
What a nice story. Mm. Now, just to get back to this, the males do have a territory. You were talking about Arnie there.
Yes.
And then of course, these developments come. As you said, the West Coast has become like another, the East Coast of Australia has become like another California.
Yep.
With the development. And so they have the territory, and then there's a road goes through there, through his territory, and they want to cross backwards and forwards. And that's a great cause of their mortality. I mean...
It is. And we have actually worked with one developer, and we created a place called Koala Beach, and that's on our website too. But we actually went to the developer and said, look, you have a really important koala habitat, and this is where Arnie and everyone was. And we said, can we radio track the animals? Can we work out how the koalas are using this site and then nestle the humans in amongst it? And it's worked. 500 houses are there. There was actually 26 endangered species. There was beautiful big black cockatoos and frogs and beautiful endangered birds. And so our scientists did all the work on that. And it is a joy for me to go there now and to see 500 families living in harmony with animals and the bush. And I really believe that that's the future. Some developers, I think, have this real scorched earth mentality. You know, you cut everything down and then sort of plant things back after the event. But I think I told you this koala called 501. And one of the reasons I could see him in the bush, he had a little spotty chin. And he died a few years ago, but I saw a koala in his territory the other day, and the baby had a spotty chin. So I'm convinced it's his grandson. So it just shows you that if you take enough care and put enough planning into these developments, there's no reason for this destruction of our world. And I'm sort of disappointed a lot in our developers with the lack of vision about that, and even more so with our politicians who don't insist on it. And I certainly see the same slash-and-burn approach here in the United States. I'm sure your listeners know what I'm saying is right.
Right. So we need to cohabit with our environment, and that we fit into our environment rather than the environment fit in around us.
And yes, exactly. And, you know, people are so much happier. I mean, can you imagine living somewhere where you drive home at night and there's a kangaroo hopping down the street? And that's how it is. And I just don't feel that people know how wonderful it is to have birds and nature around them. In my house, I went out the other night and there was a whole stack of bright green tree frogs who had just hatched. And my children sometimes say to me, I need to get a life, but I can't tell you how joyous that made me feel.
Those tree frogs, they make quite a sound, don't they?
They do, and sometimes it can be quite deafening.
Well, you're such an inspiration to us, Deborah. And,
thank you.
And everybody has this image of wonderful koala bears, and to think that they're threatened, really, which should encourage many of our listeners to go to your wonderful webpage.
Thank you.
And hear that sounds, the sounds of the koala, savethekoala.com.
Thank you, Carl.
Okay, it's been great having you.
Yeah, thanks, and I'm sure your listeners love your program. It's great to be on it. Thank you.
Oh, Alan has a question for you.
Yeah.
Hi, Deborah. I was you mentioned earlier koala families, and I was wondering about the sort of social organization of koalas, how tight-knit their families are, and how much of a problem it is if one of the family members is removed through hunting or whatever.
Well, I think that it's very important, and there is actually a colony that I did see where some people went in and actually took some animals out, and then all of a sudden the whole population disappeared. And I really believe that they took the leaders out of there. And it's interesting, in the scientific literature, there is not enough to confirm that koala society is very structured. But I really believe it is, and agree that we need to sort of get more information about that. But to actually radio track koalas for a long time, it can be very expensive. So I personally believe, after those stories of Arnie and Lulu and Marie, I know for a fact that they need leaders like all of us, and I think we need more environmental leaders in the world at the moment.
Over to Marge. Marge has a question.
Yeah, it's very admirable what you're doing, Deborah, in trying to educate people and so on. I'm just wondering, is there any legislation at all in Australia protecting these animals?
Well, tomorrow I'm going to Washington, D.C., and I'm meeting with American lawyers who I've been working with for 10 years, and we are going to write a National Koala Act. Uh-huh. Because I really believe that all existing legislation doesn't get it. Normally, legislation just says we will protect the species, and we've had that since 1936. What it doesn't do is protect the trees, and more importantly, it doesn't provide for incentives for landholders. And as I said before about the carbon trading and other options, I really believe farmers should be encouraged to grow koalas, grow trees. Great for tourism. $2.5 billion worth of tourist dollars come into our country. Perhaps, you know, the farmers can benefit from some of those things. So we're going to grapple in this legislation with some of those solutions. I think it's taken me 20 years to articulate the problems, and now my focus is looking for solutions. And here in New York City, I've been talking to American lawyers, and, you know, I always go home inspired after being here. And I promise you, before I leave my job or die, a National Koala Act will be in place.
That's wonderful. Thank you for that, and good luck.
Do any of the political parties in Australia seem to be showing interest in such a thing? And how much has this issue and other wildlife issues become a part of the political discussion in Australia?
Yeah, that's a really good question. Look, I think politicians, you know, kiss babies and cuddle koalas when they're about to go to elections. But if you look on our website too, we've got a bit of a hall of shame. There's 128 federal politicians in our country, and we asked all of them five questions. And if they got the questions right, we gave them a paw for every a claw for every question right.
Early, so
and only 12 of those politicians said, okay, I'm interested in protecting koalas. 116 of them just seem to have taken a no view. I feel that although there's a lot of green rhetoric being talked, I actually don't see much of it in our parliament.
So Arnie, the koala bear, would say, take care of the trees, because if there's no trees, there's no me. So I'll save those. And thank you for what you do, Deborah Talbot.
Yeah, thank you for being on your program, Carl. I loved it.
And
thank you.
We'll mention that webpage again.
Thank you. That's great of you. Have a lovely afternoon.
What is the webpage? SaveTheKoala.com. It's SaveTheKoala.com, and we've been speaking with Deborah Talbot, and she is the Executive Director of the Australian Koala Foundation. Thank you for being on our show. So, Alan, do you have just a... I know we have our next guest online, but can we just have a little bit of...
We're going to hear
about 10 seconds.
A few seconds of the Albatross Waltz while we get ready for the next guest. Mm-hmm. You're listening to Chris Newman playing the Albatross Waltz, and I'd like to remind you that this Sunday is Co-op Radio's annual general meeting, Sunday, November 23rd at 12:30 p.m. at the Wise Hall, which is at 1882 Adirondack Street in Vancouver, near Victoria Drive and Adirondack, just near Venables and Victoria, one block north of that. So that's this Sunday at 12:30 at the Wise Hall, 1882 Adirondack.
Yes, and you're listening to Animal Voices coming to you on CFRO Radio 102.7 FM in Vancouver, your community-based and community-sponsored radio station. Many of our programs are posted on our webpage, animalvoices.org, animalvoices.org. Well, Bob Timmons is the spokesperson for the Toronto-based ARC2 organization, and they're leading a campaign of awareness that shark fin products are widely available in many of the stores like Shoppers Drug Mart and Costco and many of the health food stores. Welcome, Bob Timmons, to Animal Voices.
How you doing, Carl?
Yeah, great. Well, you know, it's wonderful that here we have another endangered species, but probably hasn't been categorized as a endangered species. So many sharks are being killed for their fins. So maybe you can just enlarge on that and why you're doing this program.
Okay, well, actually, I got two shark campaigns on the go, one being the shark shark cartilage capsules that are being sold at Shoppers Drug Mart. They do have two actually being sold, but the one brand is Holista. We're actually looking into and trying to get put off the shelves as well as the other one. But and we have another campaign going on with the shark finning industry itself. And actually, I'd like to start off just kind of giving a background on the ocean.
Sure.
The ocean is basically the life support system of the planet, and to change that drastically would be devastating. Two-thirds of the world's surface is water. Over 80% of life on Earth lives in the ocean. And sharks have been on this planet for over 400 million years. So it's easy to believe that sharks have shaped the world since life on Earth has evolved from the sea. Also, we got like sharks are at the top of the food chain, which I'm sure everybody knows in regards to the ocean. And the main thing here is 60 to 70% of our air, our planet's oxygen, comes from the ocean by tiny microscopic plankton. It converts carbon dioxide to oxygen. So that's huge, especially when we've got global warming happening and stuff. also, sharks keep our ocean and planet balanced. So in the areas that sharks have been killed by over 90%, the plankton feeders consume... plankton feeders consume an alarming amount of plankton, thus reducing production of oxygen to our planet. So, you know, that just shows we need to keep the balance of the ocean, and you know, we got a lot of things happening that are people don't understand what's going on out in the ocean. So, in regards to Shoppers Drug Mart, what we're trying to do is get 10,000 signatures to support our stand against this huge corporation. It is a Canadian company. I believe it's only in Canada. And we have an online petition for this. It's thepetitionsite.com/35/help-save-the-shark. So anybody can access that and help us reach our goal.
Now, Bob, can people also go to your ARC 2 webpage and sign the petition?
I'm not sure if we have the link there, but that's a good idea. We could probably set it up. Could make it a lot easier. I'm sure I could have that done within the week.
So we really do have a problem with the oceans, as you pointed out there, and it's such a large part of planet Earth, and it's become the cesspool of the land. It's so much sewage and plastic bags and everything goes into the ocean, and then we destroy the wildlife within there, and the sharks are become the culprit. But now it's quite a sad story when people are pulling out these sharks, taking off their fins, and then what happens to these animals without any fins? A shark without a fin?
Well, what they're doing is the fishermen don't want to load up their boats with bodies of sharks because to them the bodies aren't worth anything. So what they're doing is they just fish them out using long lines mostly. Long lines go out miles and miles into the ocean, and many animals as well as sharks get caught on them and die. And what they're doing, they're pulling them out, they cut their fins off, and they're just throwing the bodies back into the water itself, where they drown and become fish food.
Right. And where is this happening, Bob? And which part of the world? I mean, which ocean is this predominantly? Where are the most sharks? Are they pervasive?
I'm kind of losing you a little bit there, Carl.
You what?
You're just blanking in and out. Sorry.
Right. Where are most of these sharks caught that are used in the Shoppers Drug Mart product? Okay. He's going to...
We may have lost him. I can tell he must be on a cell phone, and I can tell even with his end of it that it's going up and down quite a bit. So hopefully he'll get back on the line or else phone back from a landline or something. But it's very important. I've read some stuff on this and seen some terrible photographs of them hauling these big sharks up in the ships, and they just cut the fins off and throw the shark back. And it's just so gross. I mean, it's bad enough, Joe, to kill the fish for other purposes, but when they're just cutting the fin off and then throwing it back to the ocean still alive, and like you said, the fish can't live, of course, without its fins, and it just slowly dies in the ocean. And it's a terrible situation that that these sharks, and I just can't believe that anybody would countenance such an industry. You know, it's... because you're not only killing the animal for a small part of the animal, but you're not even killing it. You're just so maybe this is him. I'll get the phone.
Maybe
Bradley.
So
one of the aspects is also that people believe that this is a miracle cure for all kinds of cancer treatments and stuff like that. Well, I think we have Bob Timmons back on the line here. So. Well, welcome back, Bob Timmons.
Is he there?
Are you there?
How are you doing?
Great.
Yeah.
Now, a lot of people are taking these capsules and buying them from health food stores, but they believe this is the cure for cancer and the cartilage. Is that in fact so? Has that been proven?
It has not been proven. You can actually go on Shoppers Drug Mart website, and they actually... date all the tests that have been done and how none of it's actually worked. And I think that's more of a legal stance to say that they'll sell it, they'll offer it, but they're not going to stand by it either.
Right.
It's an unsustainable product that they're actually selling, so I don't think they should be supporting that.
Okay, and there are two movies that were quite dominant in creating people's images about sharks as a rule. The one was a shark, and of course there's this wonderful new documentary about shark water. Maybe you can just say something about that.
Well, Shark Water was a fantastic movie. It changed a lot within me. That brought me to this point in my life, becoming an animal activist. That movie is really broke down and really, it's not very gruesome in the fact of what they could show, but it does state what's going on out in the ocean, the corruption with governments, the corruption with, within little islands that actually are surrounded by the ocean that are really fishing out the areas. Just to mention, the Sea Shepherd as well is a very strong organization that's out there actually protecting a lot of these little areas. I believe they're around the Galapagos as well, working with the government to make sure that there's no long lines out in the ocean and no poachers are coming in and scooping out all the all the sharks in that area.
Now, when they have these, like Paul Watson was featured in this documentary, Shark Water, they have these 100-mile lines. Can you imagine a 100-mile? Is it in fact so? What are they trying to catch there in the deep ocean?
Well, they're just aiming them mainly for the sharks, but everything's getting caught on that, from turtles to other fish that will eat the bait. And sometimes these lines aren't even looked at for like weeks or months. So within that time period, these animals are tangling themselves up and having a horrible death. And when they actually get them, some are alive and some are actually already dead.
So dolphins get caught in there, and all kinds of tuna, I guess, and these long lines. And is there any movement to have these long lines for shark cartilage being made illegal or anything?
From what I know, a lot there's at least 16 countries involved already, according to Sharkwater, the movie, that are banning long lines, and we're trying to get the other countries on involved in this as well to stand. Even the inlet countries should be a part of this and being a force on this. Just because you're not near the water doesn't mean you're not a part of the water. We're all a part of it in some manner.
Thank you. Well, thank you, Bob. You know, I'd just like to refer people to go to your campaign, see your campaign, and we need those 10,000 signatures, and we need to maybe when we go into Shoppers Drug Mart and ask the people, is it true that you're selling shark cartilage capsules? So make them aware that, you know, in a very nice way, that this is, you know, against the ethical the preservation of the species, and maybe you can give us your reference there for people to sign on to the campaign.
That's great.
Can you give us the reference once again?
Where to?
To where people can go to on the web page to sign up for the campaign to make like Shoppers Drug Mart signatures.
Oh, the petition site?
Yeah.
It's the petitionsite.com/35/help-save-the-shark. or you can also email me at bob@arc-ii.com.
That's easier.
If somebody just goes to the petitionsite.com, can they just kind of follow through and find it? Because I know
you could probably search sharks and yeah, possibly.
Because I know I've signed and I recently signed another petition on the petition site, and it seemed to be fairly easy to find what I wanted there just by going to the petitionsite.com.
Right.
Yep. Anyway, I had another question. You were talking about the Shoppers Drug Mart here in Canada selling these products, but are other shark fin products available in Canada, like for food, like shark fin soup? And are there restaurants that serve that, or are they Oriental food shops that sell shark fins, you know?
There is, and that's what my second campaign is about. We're trying to infiltrate into the Asian population to stop the shark fin soup industry. So we're working towards getting into China as well. A group I'm working with in New York is sharksavers.org, I believe, and they have Wild Aid on their side, which has got Yao Ming and Jackie Chan as their representatives. And we're trying to put shark water into China, and we're trying to stop, if we can stop them and change their behavior of eating shark fin soup, and maybe give them an imitation, a vegan-style imitation of shark fin soup as a replacement, we're hoping that we can stop the demand and maybe diminish them going out to kill these sharks for this industry.
Yeah, if there's not a market anymore, clearly that's going to slow the fishing down. So, I can see it's very important to anywhere. Well, like in Vancouver here, we have a very large Chinese and very large Oriental population. This would be an important area to get at. But also places like Hong Kong and Singapore, I would think. Also, the word, you know, it's a matter, you have to try and educate people.
That's right. And the sharks, they say they believe they're magical because they don't get sick and they don't get cancer. But with all the pollution going on now in the world, sharks are starting to come up with a lot of problems. They're filled with mercury, so eating it, you're actually going to, you know, force a disease on yourself instead of actually bettering yourself, so they think.
So thank you, Bob Timmons, for being on Animal Voices. You're the spokesperson for the Toronto-based ARC2 and leading your campaign. We wish you well. Thank you for being on Animal Voices. Bye
for
now.
Thank you very much, Carl.
Okay, bye.
Bye-bye.
And once again, you're listening to Animal Voices coming to you on CFRO Radio 102.7 FM. And our webpage is animalvoices.org. And over to Alan. And do you have a little light tune for us?
We'll see what we can find.
Hold on, hold on. Keep your eyes on the prize. Hold on.
Got my hand on the gospel plow. Wouldn't take nothing for my journey now.
Keep your eyes on the prize. Hold on, hold on.
Freedom's name is mighty sweet. One of these days we're gonna meet.
Keep your eyes on the prize.
Keep
your eyes on the prize. Hold on. Hold on. Hold on. Keep your eyes on the prize.
Wonderful music that originally comes from the U.S. Civil Rights Movement. Keep your eye on the prize. And there's all kinds of prizes we should be keeping our eyes on, and the prize for us is animal rights, and getting, we would really feel that we got the prize if we could educate a few people about, you know, shark fins and koalas and all the other animals in our world that are the victims of these things. Anyway, that's a Canadian group, the Sojourners, singing that tune. Wonderful stuff. Anyway, back to the show.
Yes, and over to you, Marge. You have a story for us.
Yes, thank you, Carl. Yeah, the good, feel-good story. The baby gorilla now is called Daughter of Sunshine. And the baby gorilla was born in the zoo. Her mother, Lulu, could not produce enough milk to adequately feed her, so the zookeeper stepped in. They worked in shifts to hold the two-month-old ape in their arms for 24 hours a day, imitating the way real gorilla mothers take care of their young. The baby thrived and grew to be an exceptionally loving and gentle creature. The keepers named her Binti Jua, which means Daughter of Sunshine in Swahili. Since Binti Jua was born in captivity, she was content with the life of a zoo gorilla, climbing the trees in her enclosure and playing happily with the other gorillas. There was an old male gorilla living in the zoo, a large silverback, who had never shown any interest in fathering any offspring. Something about Binti Jua appealed to the elder ape, and when Binti was six, she became pregnant. The zookeepers were concerned that because the young gorilla hadn't had any maternal role models, she might not be fully prepared to mother her own young. So they gave her lessons. They used a stuffed animal as a baby substitute and taught her to put the baby to her breast and to hold the baby constantly, the way gorillas do in the wild. She was a good student, and when her daughter, Kula, was born, Binti Jua was the perfect mom. This combination of natural motherliness and her comfort with humans would later make her an internationally celebrated heroine. One day, when Kula was about a year and a half old, Binti Jua was in her outdoor enclosure, holding and grooming her baby as usual. The zoo visitors were all enjoying the sight of the gorillas when suddenly a little three-year-old boy who had been playing along the barrier of the enclosure toppled over the edge and fell over 20 feet to the concrete floor below. There was a sickening thud. The little boy's hysterical mother began screaming for help. Immediately, Binti Jua, still holding Kula, made her way over to the unconscious child. The watching crowd gasped in horror. Unconsciously, people tend to associate gorillas with the movie monster King Kong. What would that huge ape do to the little boy? First, the mother gorilla lifted the boy's arm as if checking for signs of life. Then, gently, she picked him up and held him tenderly to her chest. Rocking him softly as she walked, she carried him over the door to the door of the zookeeper's entrance and exit to the enclosure. When another larger female gorilla approached her, Binti Jua made a guttural sound, warning the other gorilla to stay away. By this time, the door was open, and the keepers were there with the paramedics who had been called to rescue the injured boy. The gorilla carefully placed the boy on the floor in front of the door, and the paramedics whisked the child away. When the door closed again, Binti Jua calmly walked back to her tree and began grooming her own baby once more. The people watching were stunned. The event would have dramatic enough effect without the role of the heroine being played by a gorilla. And Binti Jua was the best type of heroine, not caring for either fame or reward. The boy recovered without any lasting harm resulting from his adventure, and the world was moved by Binti Jua's good deed. Letters and gifts came pouring in from all over the world. She even received a medal from the American Legion and an honorary membership in a California PTA. Acting from her heart, Binti Jua did what any mother would do. She protected and helped a child. But this gorilla didn't care that the child was of another species. She showed the qualities we humans hold most dear, love and compassion. That little story comes from Carol Klein, and it's published in Chicken Soup for the Pet Lover's Soul.
Thank you, Marge. And over to Alan, because he has another animal story.
And in a sense, it's a feel-good story, too. At least it's a story of progress. I just got my most recent edition of The Marmoteer. The Marmoteer is the seasonal newsletter from the Marmot Recovery Foundation in Vancouver Island, and it's about the Vancouver Island marmot. We were talking earlier about how few koalas there are in the world, but in fact, in the whole world, there are less than 200 Vancouver Island marmots. This is an incredibly small, it is one of the rarest animals in the whole world, and it's right here on Vancouver Island. It's one of those creatures that's been a victim of the progress of British Columbia. As the forests in Vancouver Island have been clear-cut, this animal that lives on the mountains, high on the hills on Vancouver Island, has had a lot of its habitat removed. And it got down to the point whereas in 2001 there were 38 marmots left in the world. And at that time, finally, the scientists started alerting the world, and a group of scientists got together and realized that something had to be done. And as well as finding some support, getting some money, because the Liberal government in Victoria has not been very helpful in this whole campaign until the last year or so. And they managed to raise the money, get some to buy some of the land where these marmots are living, and then they've started this marmot breeding and reentry program. This can be very difficult to breed animals and then to introduce them into the wild. But they've had amazing successes. And this last year, 59 marmots were released two sites on Vancouver Island, which is a huge success. And now the population, starting from 2001, where it was down to 38 animals, it's now the population in the wild is 160 animals. And there's quite a few more in breeding facilities, both in Vancouver Island and in Calgary. And the other thing they've done in Vancouver Island, when they started working, the marmots were only in one site, and now they found two other sites on Vancouver Island where the marmots used to live, and they're introducing these animals, some of them, to these other sites too, so they're not all in one place, because clearly they're very vulnerable if you have the whole species, the whole population in one place. So now they're introducing them into three different places, and they're surviving and breeding. So the other part of the success is that the animals they've been introducing to the wild have been breeding. So they are actually able to produce more marmots in the wild. So this is a great thing, but it's something worth considering supporting. Co-op Radio here is worth supporting, but something like the Marmot Recovery Foundation is also worth supporting, and keep it in mind. It's a good sort of thing if you're buying a Christmas gift for somebody, because they do a subscription program and so on at the Marmot Recovery Society. You can check them out at www.marmots.org, that's plural, marmots.org, you'll find out a lot of information there. But it's an amazing, wonderful little animal that is one of the few species of marmots, and it is one of the world's most endangered animals, and here it is right in our neighborhood, and we can do something to help these people on Vancouver Island protect these animals and help them to get back on their feet, so to speak.
Now, Alan, you're a member of this organization, and to save the marmots, but is it... What is it as animal related to the marmot? Is it a gopher or what is it?
Well, it's like a gopher. We have in British Columbia other species of marmots that people would possibly have seen. If you go to up into the Rockies or even up around Whistler, you'll see marmots around there. The other species, I think there are six species in North America, and most of them are healthy populations, but the Vancouver Island marmot that is isolated on Vancouver Island and quite vulnerable is the species that's really in trouble. But the marmot, it's like a very large gopher. They're a larger animal. They're probably, if you from tail head to tail, probably close to 3 feet long, certainly more than 2 feet long, and probably weigh about 10 pounds. They kind of look like a big gopher, but most people would have seen marmots when you're traveling around the hills in British Columbia. They're pretty common sight. Often you see them sitting up on a rock. They like to make burrows and live in areas where there's lots of rocks and so on. And, tend to, live not down here on sea level so much, but up in mountain slopes. It's pretty common. If you stop at a picnic site or a campground or something, you're driving around BC, you'll see a marmot sitting up watching you.
So if anybody had to go up Table Mountain, which is the mountain just behind Cape Town, the city is down below, and then you'll see this wonderful Table Mountain. You can go up in the cable car. And there's a little animal there called a dassie. And it's a bit like, it also lives between the rocks. And there's not much vegetation up there because it's so windswept up there on top of Table Mountain. But it's a marmot-like animal. And what's really totally amazing about the dassie is that its nearest genetic link is the elephant. And this little gopher animal is a genetic likeness of has so much in common with the elephant. Anyway, Marge.
I just wanted to ask Alan about Calgary. It seems an odd place to be saving the West Coast marmot.
Well, they're just like they're breeding them there and then bringing them back to Vancouver Island. They're not introducing them there. It's just that the facilities were there and somebody there was willing to put up the money because they've had a lot of trouble. Like I said, it's only just and very recently, and the British Columbia government the Liberal government here finally, just like I said, last year saw the light. And in fact, for the upcoming Olympics, the Vancouver Island marmot is one of the mascot animals that they're having. So they've kind of, which is good, you know, I mean, it's kind of a silly thing, but at least it is raising the profile and will help to raise more money, hopefully, to carry on this work, because It takes huge amount of person hours, a lot of time to build the facilities, raise these animals. Same as the introduction. It's a long process to take the animal up, and you have to slowly introduce each one at a time, introduce them out into the wild, and try and look after them for the first little while. But it's working.
A lot of dedicated volunteers working on it.
Indeed. Yeah.
They're vulnerable to eagles preying on them.
Well, the biggest predators are cougars and
coyotes,
right? Cougars and coyotes. And normally, it wouldn't be a problem. If you had a healthy population, then you'd get, you know, so many we killed every year. But when you've only got a few of them there, each one that a cougar takes, you know, is a big problem.
Now, Marge, you have another announcement here. So over to you.
I have an announcement. I don't think I have time.
Two minutes and a bit.
I'll have to do it next time, I think.
Okay.
It's about the price of pet drugs that I want to enlighten our audience.
We'll have that
about
at the top of the show next week.
Top of the show. Stay tuned to Animal Voices. Yes, and what we also have here was we're looking for good news stories here. This was an article in the Vancouver Sun. This was this past week. And that was concerning the dramatic rescue for doomed wild horses. And that the headline says here, billionaire's wife announces she'll adopt a herd of 30,000 horses. Well, 30,000, I mean, that's incredible, a number of horses that she's going to rescue. But Madeline Pickens is the wife of the billionaire T. Boone Pickens, and she has made her intentions known to adopt not just the doomed wild horses, but most of all the 30,000 horses kept in federal holding pens. Well, Boone Pickens and his wife have been lifelong animal lovers, and just a few years ago, they led the fight to close the last horse slaughterhouse in the United States. Well, sadly, we know now that many of these horses are finding their way to under the name of going for pasture in Canada, but in fact, they're headed to the slaughterhouses in Canada. And last year, some 80,000 horses were slaughtered in Canada for their meat, shipped all over the world. So this is another interesting aspect of how comes there were 30,000 horses in federal government care. Well, this is what happened is that the federal government in the United States has been rounding up wild horses since the 1980s, putting them in holding facilities and offering them for adoption to horse lovers who promise not to sell them for slaughter. But the roundups became aggressive until the Bush administration, under the Bush administration. So now, of course, the aspect of a new administration and maybe a kinder attitude towards the horses and extinct species and the animals. So, well, you're listening to Animal Voices on CFR Radio 102.7 FM. And in closing, we'd like to just quote the Greek poet Hesiod, who wrote, "As long as man continues to be the ruthless destroyer of lower living beings, he will never know health or peace. For as long as men massacre animals, they will kill each other. Indeed, he who sows the seed of murder and pain cannot reap joy and love." And thank you for listening to Animal Voices.